Welcome back to What's About. I thought he was never going to let us in there. Brody?
Show About Art. Brody, my mic's not on.
It is.
There we go.
Show About Art, that's a work of art. It's what we like to think, Sally.
We do like to think so.
Merit is not up to us to decide, though.
No, of course not. No.
Especially with all the fumbling that's going on beforehand.
Well, the man behind the curtain's having a little trouble there this morning, but perhaps he's drunk.
We're here. Maybe he is, absolutely.
I'm troubled anyway, so...
Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. And you're here with me, Sally Bailiw, and Artist-in-Residence and Cultural Sounding Board John Baird, the always amazing and regularly controversial Mark Stewart, who has a birthday this week. So happy birthday to Mark. And Brody Guzzi is catching up with us. What are you going to talk with us about today, John?
Learning to swim.
These things always sound like they've got nothing to do with art, but of course they always do.
Well, oddly, my tale of learning to swim will involve Botticelli's Venus, of course.
Of course it will. And Mark, what about you? Is it age-themed today?
No, maybe I'm going to talk about sperm and feminism.
Of course you are.
I've been reading a little bit about sperm too lately. Yes, I have indeed.
In relation to feminism?
Yes, basically. And in relation to The Handmaid's Tale and the sort of the idea of what's happening to humanity in general.
Something to talk about.
So what about the Archibald? Are we going to be talking about that?
The fish and chips of the art prize world.
Yes.
You know, great in anticipation, but very disappointing when it comes around to the result.
Okay.
Always with fish and chips, you have that problem?
With fish and chips?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm sure we're going to get onto it in one way or another. A little bit later on in the show, in fact, very, very soon, we have Mia Drag Yankovic coming in to join us for a bit of a chat about many things, perhaps the Archibalds, perhaps his career in music, and also perhaps as surviving as an artist. He's a local painter and of the most wonderful skies, and he's also runs the art shop upstairs in Rye. The idea of being able to live a sustainable artistic life on the peninsula is a dream for many, but Mick is living proof it's possible, so we plan to pick his brains a little before we get him in here. We're also going to be talking to local actor, director and filmmaker Frank McGree, whose recent short film Sengatan, starring another local, Drew Head, is in the short film selection at the Melbourne Film Festival, which began a few days ago. So while we get Mick into the studio, here is a track from an album that he recorded, apparently in one take, at the Rye Primary School. Library. It's with his band called The Swifts, and it's a track called Undercover.
Mia Drag Yankovic there with the band. What's the band called, Mick?
The Swifts, John.
Yeah, that was terrific. I enjoyed that. Very poppy. I prefer to call Mia Drag Mick.
I think most people do.
Most people call me Mick.
And Mick surviving on the peninsula as an artist, and as Sally pointed out, a painter of beautiful skies. You know what Robert Hughes said about Titian skies, Mick?
No, I don't, John. Fill me in.
He said Titian painted such beautiful skies that no one noticed the guy and a goat in the foreground.
Sounds good to me.
Brody's rolling his eyes already. We've told him he's in for a ride
now
today.
Mickey, you and I have had a couple of chats in a local cafe in Rye about what's going on with art in the community in the broader world.
And
you're a person who's been producing paintings for a long time. You've been involved with galleries and other businesses.
You've obviously
got a little bit of a business head about you, and you're these days surviving as an artist without the aid of agents or commercial galleries. Well, without contracts is perhaps the better way.
One of the main elements of survival is that you do involve yourself in every aspect of your career, and that is the business side, the marketing side, the production side, I believe these days you can't just paint in a studio and then believe to be found popular and have commercial success, but
well, that's not going to happen. But
that's not going to happen.
You really have to put yourself out of agents, which is the way that a lot of people go about it. They will put themselves in the hands of agents or gallery directors.
They do, but you're competing probably with another 50 or 60 other people in the stable, and so you only have a limited exposure during that time, which is either 2 or 3 weeks during your exhibition. And after that, you're basically put on the scrap heap. If you don't have a sellout show, you tend to be limited to your income. So therefore, in order to expose your work 24/7, or what are you, 365 days, you're more or less you have to approach a lot of galleries, or have your own gallery, also work the social media quite heavily, and just put yourself out there. Otherwise, it's a sort of an art of self-promotion. The other part of my business is also I've been a master picture framer for 20 years. I had a picture framing business, conservation picture framing business in Brian, and that put me in touch with the inner workings of how to work a gallery, how to present your work, how to deal with other artists and galleries, and yeah, it's a life of being totally involved in art and the business of art.
I gather that you also don't like paying commissions. Will it be part of it, Mickey?
Well, who does?
You pay yourself that commission.
Look, I think commissions are a necessary part if you're not willing to do a lot of work yourself. So you have to leave other people to do it, and therefore galleries will do all, you know, the promotion and the marketing and all that. Ideally, I think but the only thing is that commissions tend to drive the prices up quite high. And as you develop through your career, your prices get to a point where almost, there's only, you know, small cake in Australia to, you know, to buy artwork. It's there's only, you know, so many people to buy artwork. And yeah. I don't think the public is really educated in art now. We haven't really broadened the cake as... Mm.
The other argument, of course, is that paying a commission to a commercial gallery, what you're doing is paying them a commission, but you're also buying their expertise in the marketplace.
And, yeah, I agree.
It's expertise that you then don't have to have in order to wade your way through it, and you've got more time to paint, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I have exhibited with commercial galleries since 1981. So originally I started off with Power Street Gallery, and I was totally committed to them till 1992. That was the last show there before the whole market just crashed. And after that, I went... incognito. Me and my wife had kids. We moved down to the peninsula and started enjoying life with the kids. And then I went into full-time painting again in 2000. And it was then that I decided that maybe the commercial galleries are not my go. And therefore, I started showing at local galleries like Oak Hill Gallery and Antipodes Bookshop and places like that, just to create some sort of base of interest from, you know, local people. And the support's been fantastic from the local art buyers down here, so I'm very, very happy. There's also, by starting my gallery 4 years ago, there's been quite a lot of people that have come upstairs to my gallery and purchased paintings that have gone back to Melbourne. And commercial galleries don't, they work for you, but they're also it's the same scenario. People have to come into the gallery to have a look at your work, and if they're not prepared to do the footwork,
I think there are galleries who are quite professional and others who are less professional.
Absolutely.
If you think about New York, for example, where they take 70% commission,
yep,
they will take that 70% commission because they know they're going to sell every painting before the show even opens.
I'd love
for
that.
For $1 million.
So this is why the more the higher the prices, the more the commission, everybody gets happy more or less. But you are actually a slave of that gallery, and they define what you're going to do and what you're not going to do if you want to make some money. money from it.
So that's right.
There is a compromise, but at the same time, they do look after you. They do all the work, and you can. And they, a lot of people get a stipend.
Yeah, I understand that. That's gone back a while, even back to the Jackson Pollock days. Yes. So my intent was that the gallery doesn't dictate what I produce. Mm. My development as an artist is really up to me. Mm. And therefore, when I put on a show, and I do have a show starting at Without Pier Gallery in October, that I do a suite of paintings, which are, I think, part of my development.
But as you probably well know, if you're not in the gallery system, you're out.
Yeah.
And you're not getting promoted as you can see in the Wynne Prize and the Archibald Prize. Most of these artists are with a good gallery. They've been promoted by a gallery, and that's why they're more or less successful,
but
because they're people are getting seen.
Mickey's what kind of proving the point that you can do it in a different way. I think you're doing quite
can
well,
aren't
you?
Can you explain success?
Well,
as in,
look, it's a very. In this instance, I'm talking about commercial, financial
success. Yeah.
Whether it makes anybody happy is another question altogether.
Yeah.
You can look at Brett Whiteley as a perfect example of someone who had enormous success but was basically intrinsically a very unhappy man.
Well, my success, my definition of success is when I do a breakthrough in a painting.
Mm.
Not about whether it's sold or not.
Yeah, but we can all have breakthroughs in paintings personally. Yet, you know, it depends on how it's been, how it goes through into society.
That's not what you told me down there.
I don't suffer from other people's opinions.
No, you told me, Mickey, down the cafe.
But we're not talking about our own opinions here. We're talking about the general opinion, which we don't suffer from, but we have to deal with if we're going to look at how important a painting is going to be in the long term, or a sculpture, for that example. I saw a very, very good exhibition in London of all the painters who were quite famous in their time and who have been completely forgotten about since. And it was a wonderful show to see these people who were having great success and then suddenly gone. And it's something we all have to deal with at some stage. I think the big question is how you define success, finally.
That's
And it is true that you have to define it to yourself first.
Yeah.
Mm. It's interesting. I really think it looks to me as if the model is changing, and the digital world has had a big effect on various creative arts, particularly and obviously the music industry and how we buy music and how we experience music now, and certainly the literary circles. I mean, it's had a big, technology has had huge impacts everywhere, and my guess is the visual arts as well. This is probably a new way that is developing, and presumably and perhaps with great trepidation, perhaps we look at artists having to deal with a whole lot of other things that artists have previously never really enjoyed dealing or been able to deal with.
Well, I'll just give you a quick example. On YouTube, there are 17 days of content uploaded every minute. Okay, so what you're talking about with digital, what we're seeing, you know, I remember when websites first came into being, these friends saying, you've got to have a website, And you look at a lot of the websites, these people, they should never have a website. They shouldn't be allowed to have a website, basically. And I think we're dealing a lot with too much stuff.
Shouldn't be allowed to have
a website. Well, this is it. I was thinking about this. The tyrant, you know, if I was a tyrant, there'd be a lot of jogging. The outers
there'd be all sorts of things going on.
Our time goes so very, very fast. You mentioned a little earlier that you have an exhibition that might be coming up in October. Is that right?
Yeah, it starts on the 8th of October till the 22nd at Without Pier Gallery in Bay Road, Cheltenham.
Yeah.
And it's called Endlessness.
Endlessness.
Lots of S's
Which
in there.
Gallery is that in Bay Road?
Without Pier Gallery.
Okay. Will you...
What's the address? Sorry.
I don't know. Yeah. It's just Bay Road.
Will you let us know when that's happening? Because we'd like to promote it on here and let people know that that's happening. Is it just you singularly?
Don't know who the other artist is, but I'm the important one.
Yeah, we don't know much yet, but we'll find out. I think it would be fabulous to have you pop in on another occasion. We're running out of time, I'm sorry to say.
Well, thank you very much for the time.
It was wonderful to talk to you. Just one other question quickly. You have an art shop and a framing shop and a gallery.
No. I don't do framing anymore. What I have is it's called Art Upstairs, Gallery Art Upstairs at 2375 Point Nepean Road, Rye.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also an open studio, so paint up there, as well as there's a display of about 30 paintings or so on the walls. And you're more than welcome to come up and chat anytime. Any artists that are interested in talking art or whatever, chew the fat. And see work in progress. And hopefully my lease will be renewed in September.
Yeah, hopefully.
And do you serve coffee? Do you serve coffee?
Well, I can do an instant.
No. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.yankovicart.com.au.
I will put a link to that, of course, on our Facebook page. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us
today. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Mickey.
Thanks, Sally.
And now it's time for John
On. No, it's not.
What do you mean it's not?
I thought we were going to do Frank.
Oh!
Well, but I'm happy to do John On, you know, and Frank will enjoy this. Frank, he's sitting there, you know.
I know, Frank's just come into the studio.
I know no one else knows that, but I'm just, I'm running free with this,
He is. We're all over the place.
Run.
When I learned to swim as a child, I was a very small child learning to swim, and I was a very good swimmer as a small boy. But the reason wasn't that I wanted to be a good swimmer. The reason was that I didn't like putting my feet down on the sea floor. And swimming was a way of avoiding putting my feet down. And the reason that I didn't like doing that was because I spent some of my time sitting on a striped carpet at home with the Astor television on, watching Adventures in Paradise.
Oh, and it seemed like that.
Every week Adam Troy would get his foot stuck in a giant clam. And I was terrified of the same thing happening to me. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting when he did. He'd get his foot stuck in these clams and then he'd struggle for a while. Then he would realise that he had a knife with him on his belt and he'd sort of stab away at the clam and something like blood would come out and he'd be released and he'd get away. But on one occasion I remember a couple of Polynesians appeared out of nowhere just swimming underwater and they helped him get out of the clam.
Yes.
And then they kind of swam off, never to be seen, perhaps on their way to New Zealand or something, I don't know. They're very underwater Polynesians. And I used to think about Adam Troy and the giant clam in terms of Botticelli, because I made the mistake of thinking that Botticelli's Venus was standing in a clam shell. She's actually standing in a scallop shell.
Oh, yes.
And yes. It's Venus. I used to think of her as Eve. And I used to think of her as Eve because her partner in that tableau would, of course, be Adam.
Yes.
And it made sense to me that Adam Troy and Botticelli's Eve would be...
It all comes together.
...stuck together in a clamshell together, you know. But I did make a few mistakes there. Clams I've been thinking about, clamshells. And, you know, a giant clam, there's not many of them left because they've been harvested from all around the world. They grow in shallow water because they need sunlight to grow the algae that they live on. And so they've been massively harvested and mostly for suburban gardens in Western cities. You know, clamshells sit under the tap so that the tap can drip into a clamshell instead of onto the ground and the ground doesn't get wet or something. My grandparents had one which was standing on a little pile of fossils in the backyard and was a bird bath, but it was also a hunting ground for the local cat, the neighbour's cat. And so I sat there and watched a couple of hideous murders, and which sort of added to my horror of the clam, you know, the clam shell.
I've seen some of those beautiful clams alive and they are just unbelievably spectacular.
They are beautiful,
because they have these luminous, like a blue-ringed octopus does, that luminous markings on the lips of it.
It's they're a mollusk, same as the octopus, same family.
Are they?
Yeah. Octopuses and mollusks. Octopuses and mollusks that have got rid of their shell. The only hard part of an octopus is its beak.
Yes.
It is a mollusk.
So, of course, having run out of clamshells, real clamshells from around the world, people started producing them cast in concrete. I've seen a number of those. The porcelain clamshell was a favourite thing for a while. I've even seen a bronze clamshell sitting sort of incongruously on a bronze sea on top of the water, like a boat. So something like that. You wouldn't see that, would you? You'd never see that.
That's ridiculous.
So is this leading towards the Archibald?
No.
Oh.
No one knows where it's leading.
Well, it's leading towards you, Frank.
It is actually leading towards
him clamming up. Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, the great thing about clams and the giant clams is that there's a clam is code for the female genitalia, of course. Mm-hmm. And vagina dentata became a very important part of 20th century art, particularly with Pablo Picasso and his use of that as a description of how he felt about women, I guess.
I think it was more the 19th century French who were using it as a symbol, as a titillation.
Well, you'd know.
I would. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Picasso made it a little bit more obvious.
Vaginal dentation. Now, there's a subject that perhaps we should get to one of these days.
Vaginal dentata.
Dentata, I should say.
You bet.
Yeah, of course.
One of my favourite subjects.
Okay, let's go no further. Now, as we already seem to have our next guest, Frank McGree, in the studio with us, let's go on straight away and have a chat with Frank about his new film. Some of us imagine Bali to be a paradise, but we're hearing frequently it's also become a place of nightmares for a growing number of participants in the international drug trade. Frank McGree is an actor, and you might have seen him in Romper Stomper. He's a writer, a director, and a filmmaker, and he's made a short film about that Bali underworld. Imagine from a true story he came across while he was in Bali. The film's called Sengitan and has been wildly celebrated on the film festival circuit, winning innumerable awards here and internationally. He's here to tell us a little bit about it. Welcome to the show, Frank McGree.
Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. Frank, it is what compelled you in the first place to make this film?
Well,
did I say its name correctly?
Sengitan,
yes,
you said
I did.
It correctly.
Yeah, great.
Which means what?
Which means the sting in Indonesian.
Okay.
Which is giving a little bit away, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were on a surf trip many years ago and we met a guy and this is his story. And we took it with a grain of salt at the beginning of the surf trip and then towards the end after just continually talking to him about it, we went, wow, this is a great story. And so we made it.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, it's not one like the Coen brothers, is it? This is their film Fargo, or that fabulous film Fargo and the series that it's become, which begins with this is a true story.
Yeah.
Is it really a true story?
No, well, we believe this guy and he was pretty authentic and, yeah.
I mean, all stories are true stories.
Okay. I can see why, because Australians are really used to hearing these kind of stories where they're coming out fast and furiously, from Indonesia particularly, but also from further around the world. Mm. It's interesting because I've had a look. The number of nominations and wins you've had at festivals around the world is rather exciting. I'm fascinated that Americans would actually, because they're a bit prudish generally.
Yeah, it's done really well in America.
Yeah, so I see.
I think the Americans probably appreciate the underlying tension. No, I just saw it this morning on the telephone.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting how you managed to get that tension. The music you chose was very good.
Also, yeah, we had a great composer.
Great composer. Who's that?
Ned Beckley. Right. He's based in Perth and he's going to be working on our next projects as well.
Yeah,
he's a genius.
It had just in that short, how long did it go? 10 minutes, I think.
11 minutes.
11 minutes to get that tension building very, very soon. It was quite good. It was well done. But you're playing the detective, are you?
Correct.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It was good. You're a good actor.
Don't give it away.
Well, I'm not, aren't we?
And true.
But I think the Americans love it just because it's kind of like the Wild West in Bali. And it really is like that. I think they think Asians is such a faraway place. Like we're going to be shooting another film out of America, but shooting back in Bali or Nusa Lombongan, a feature film
been
attached to, based on what they've seen. And for them, like shooting in Indonesia is like shooting in the Congo. They just don't get it how it's another suburb of Melbourne, of Australia, Bali.
Well, yes, to some degree it is. Although there's an awful lot of undercurrents, I suspect, very different.
And
culturally different that perhaps even Australians aren't aware of. What was also fabulous, which I wonder whether the Americans are lapping it up, is that those Australian characters. I mean, the characters of both you and Drew Head, who is the mule in this lovely film, are very, your characters we don't see a lot of. You're these really Australian yeah. folk, aren't you?
Yeah, and they do. They're always fascinated with Australians and, yeah.
And the language too.
And the language and just how, I guess, I reckon we're just pretty honest.
And Drew does a terrific job in the film, and I watched you both in the film and wasn't really thinking about, that's Frank and Drew doing, because the film is so good, I'd sort of lost the idea that it was the two of you doing it until, of course, the mugshot appeared, and then I thought, oh, that's Drew.
Well, Drew had, he hasn't done much acting. But I don't know if you could find an actor out there like him. Like, he's so authentic in the role.
Yeah.
And that's, I actually like using non-actors in my films because I like finding some really raw characters like him.
The danger is that you end up with people who are utterly aware of the camera while Drew seems to be able to... he's acting, I suppose, but it's a very natural performance.
And that's convincing, very convincing. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's down to the whole production as well to get that performance out of a non-actor. And a lot of the shots we used were when the camera technically wasn't rolling. It was rolling, but there was no action being called.
Really?
So a lot of these reactions you see
are
in the front and the back end of what we're shooting. Of him just getting ready to do his performance.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's the second time I've seen you on film together.
What was
and
the first?
The first one was Go, Go, Go.
Oh, right.
Which was, I think that was in the very first Peninsula Short Film Festival.
That's right, one came second.
It came second, absolutely. And we were also, it was just a fabulous, fabulous film. So was that your first film?
Yeah, it was.
Right. So from there, you've obviously been going on a lot more. You've obviously been doing quite a few more.
Yeah. We're going to be shooting one in Zimbabwe later in this year. And then hopefully this feature will be shot in sort of April next year.
The feature of this short
film? No, it's a separate feature. It's not my script. Just got attached to it. When we were in America, we had meetings in LA after we were at the Brooklyn Film Festival.
Mm.
And some producers in Australia showed these guys in America, Senkatan, and they loved the feel of it. They loved the tension we created in it. They showed me the script. We had meetings about the script and we did some rewrites and then we've been attached.
Okay. And was the Indonesian girl in the film a real actress or...?
No.
She just walked through the shot.
Trust Mark, who picked her up. Absolutely. Now, Senkatan is playing in the short film section at the Melbourne Film Festival this year, which is very exciting.
It's a really good festival.
It is.
People don't realise how world-renowned this Melbourne International Film Festival
is. When is it?
It's our film. It starts this on the 3rd, the whole festival.
Yes, it's already running and it goes through until the 20th of August. And Senkatan is running on two occasions, isn't it? The 13th and the 17th.
That's correct. 13th at 4 p.m. At the Hoyts in the city.
Yep.
And I think we're going next weekend, John.
Are we?
Yeah, for a film.
What are you seeing?
Do you remember the name of the film? It's about an Aboriginal who comes back from the war and such... getting some
family.
Revenge.
Family, I think. Is it called Family? No.
I forget the name. I should know.
Am I going to see a film with you next week, Mark? What's news to me?
Fantastic. I will put a link to the Short Film Festival on our website.
Yep.
It's wonderful to talk to you. And it's also wonderful to have another Magree on the show again.
Oh, yes.
Once after all this time. Because, of course, it was Frank's older sister, Donna, who used to do Donna's Roundup on Arts About. And we all miss her terribly.
We do.
God bless her.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fantastic to talk to you today, Frank Magree.
Good luck with it.
And more awards, I do hope, are coming. And we wait with bated breath to hear about the film in Zimbabwe and so on. Please keep us in the loop.
No worries.
Thanks Frank.
That's wonderful. Now, we're going to listen to a little birthday song for Mark. Well, it's a kind of a party song for Mark. And it's not to say that he's petulant or anything like that, but it is a fabulous song. This is Amy Winehouse and It's My Party with Quincy Jones. So, happy birthday to you, Mark.
Thank you, Sally.
Now it's time for... That's amazing. I never knew that.
Well, I think you might know what I'm going to speak about.
Well, you did mention it a little bit earlier.
Yes. I did. So, sperm and feminism.
Mm-hmm.
as you might know, John, sperm concentrations in Western society have declined by more than 50% over the last 40 years.
I did hear that.
Mm.
And they're thinking it's perhaps the environmental toxins, milk, maybe, and obesity.
Maybe a certain percentage of Western men are getting vasectomies. Does that count?
No, that doesn't count. No. Apparently, wearing tight jeans is not good, or hot baths. Oh. So
except
be
that Western men and Japanese men have hot baths regularly.
Yes. Well, they say that in Asia and Africa, it's not a problem. Their sperm counts are still high.
So it's got to be an environmental culture.
Well, it could also be the aging of the population, but they don't really know. It could
maybe
just be
too
much luxury.
Maybe it's speaking English.
Maybe it's speaking English.
Well,
maybe
we
should be speaking
not.
French. I think the French have the same problem, though. It's not really helping them.
Yeah, but the French deserve it.
Well, it's very interesting given that just about the entire female population at the moment has been completely obsessed by The Handmaid's Tale, which is a remake of a film, but a remake of a film of a book that Margaret Atwood wrote.
Mm.
Have you seen it, Mark?
No.
Oh,
no.
Well, interestingly, it's also... it's a story about what happens to a society where an authoritarian regime comes in after personal rights have been eroded for some time because of the fears of terrorism and so on, and to the point that there is a regime change. There's obviously a coup of some description, and a very Christian group comes in, and their main line is that the population has been limited, the sperm counts are down so badly, but nobody's having any children, so they bring in a mechanism to actually bring children, and essentially it's enslaving fertile women.
Mm.
It's amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
But isn't that what marriage is? No?
Not in my books. Not in my house.
So this is a series on television, is it?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Oh, you must watch it. It is fabulous.
Don't have a television.
Oh, okay. Well,
Damn and blast.
Watch it on the computer.
I don't have it.
He doesn't have room for a television. You could get rid of one of the pianos.
I could get rid of one of the pianos, but then I'd need Telstra, wouldn't I? Because I haven't got any internet.
Oh.
But anyway, I'll see it eventually. So look, to get back to the sperm count, there's 50 million sperm per ejaculation. Mm-hmm. For most people, but only one sperm is needed. So it seems a little bit exaggerated that they have 50 million just for one. And you think of it, we are all winners. We are each one of us.
One of 50 million.
What I would like to know is, have we been elbowing them out and tripping them up and wanting to get
is
in?
There is, technique?
Is there a technique?
I don't even feel sorry for the others.
No, John.
Yeah.
So, I've just one last point to get on with, move on to feminism. I thought always that when you say I'm coming, it should be for men, it should be I'm going.
Yes, it should be.
And women should be saying I'm coming.
Yes.
So I think we should change that, John. We should be what saying now, I'm going.
French women arrive, don't they?
J'arrive.
Yeah.
Ah.
No, that's saying I'm coming is as in I'm coming, I'm arriving at the house. Juju is there. That's I'm playing actually. Sorry, it's juju is juice is to have an orgasm, but it's to play.
Okay.
But don't forget that in French, a penis is masculine, is feminine, and a vagina is feminine. Everybody,
is masculine.
The other way around. Yes.
Sorry. That's the.
What? Yes. Can you explain that to me?
No. Not at all.
Okay. All right.
Like, why do we call a car a she? You know, the car is feminine, or a boat. I guess a boat because it's full of people and full of semen. No.
Possibly.
Military boat, of course.
Brody, don't need to grimace. So look, moving on to the Wynne Prize. I think we'll just forget about feminism.
All right, the Wynne Prize.
The Archibald. So we've got the photo of this lovely couple. They look like a tediously boring couple of people in front of their painting, which is... I suppose
Mitch Cairns and his partner,
who sounds like
Agatha Goth Snape,
who sounds like a German Baroque castle.
It's a good name, Agatha Goth Snape.
I guess the merit of the painting is what's at interest here, and I'm kind of I doubt the painting myself. I doubt its sincerity. Actually, I think that it's far too graphic. It's poster art. It's not. It doesn't really ring as a sincere work of art.
Mm. It's been much criticised by vocally by quite a few artists, Tim Olson being probably the
Mind
loudest.
Given that the painting was selected for the prize and then given the award, then there must be a number of people who have some kind of authority in the area who've given it their
Well, as they say here, clout. Cairns win widely predicted. What does that mean?
Yes.
You know, the gallery's been pushing it for him to be in there. I mean, he's been a finalist four times and runner-up twice.
Yeah, well, that would...
So
that
I think they're saying, you know, but he's only 32. He looks like he's about 50.
But they do... I think in the same article, they do talk about a lot of artists that, you know, it's their time is due. And I wonder whether or not that's what... that to some extent, that's what it's about, is that you present enough times, you're maybe going to get selected.
Yeah, maybe. I get the Matisse thing in the picture. You know, and Matisse's great sort of remark that a painting should be like an armchair for a tired businessman or whatever it was that he said.
What?
That you know, when you go home after a day of work, that a painting should... you should find some secour in a painting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what if you don't work?
Well, you're not going to be able to afford the painting, are you?
Well, that also just assumes that that only the person who owns the painting can respond to it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, look, I think we're all agreed that it's nicely put together, but it doesn't really say so much.
It's a bit tedious. It's kind of glib.
Glib. Yeah. I like that.
And they look glib. Yeah, they,
I think that's a very unfortunate photograph that the Guardian have chosen on that we're looking at the moment. Yeah,
well, and they talk about their 2-year-old son at home, and it's all very sort of lovely and bourgeois and suburban and terribly tedious.
What about the win, Mark?
Yeah.
Well, the win is this Aboriginal woman, Betty Kuntiwa Pumami, whose painting, it looks like a nice painting.
Yeah.
I don't know what else you can say. For me, most Aboriginals who are painting these in now are really laughing to the bank. They're laughing all the way.
Well, they have a different approach.
They haven't a word for art. There's no word in their language in all their languages for art.
Nearly everything they do is produced by the community for the community, and art is
part of that.
So for them, it's not important that a person makes a painting, for instance. No. A whole lot of other people can work on that picture, and one person sticks their name to it in order for it to be marketed, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, not exactly.
But it doesn't mean that it's not art.
Sincere.
It's just or sincere. In fact, it's some of the best art produced in this country is produced by the Indigenous machine. It's just produced differently from the way we're used to doing it.
Yes, I don't question that. I think it's wonderful, the way that people can get together and produce something. And it's community art at its best. And there are some wonderful examples of good art. I just, the problem is, how can we really tell what's best and what's not so good?
How can we tell?
Well, when you go to the Fed Square in town, you see a lot of really, really bad Aboriginal paintings.
And but some you prefer, don't you? You prefer some to
the
others?
But
the fact that you prefer some to others means that you're making a merit kind of judgment.
I am, but I'm also saying that there's a lot of rubbish goes up as well, and that we should be able to sort of not have to see that rubbish. There needs to be more of a people need to be more critical.
But that is very subjective, of course, you saying that it's rubbish, and obviously the curators of these exhibitions do not think that. Yeah.
But I think, isn't it something which is in general, that there's a lot of questions about what Aboriginal art is good and what is not so good? Hasn't there been an enormous amount of stuff made, sort of whipped out?
Well, it's difficult because we tend to judge art through the cultural paradigm of an experience of a civilization that we are part of and that we understand, and we understand all the language of it. Indigenous art, we don't understand that language, so we're struggling to make some judgments about it.
Well, it's been fairly well explained what their languages they're using. I mean, it's mostly campsites and dream figures, we don't even really need to know exactly what the change what they're about. But what I'm saying is, we do know when we see a really good one, how it's a standout painting, and they do stand out. They're magnificent. I think there are, you know, there is this hierarchy of, yep. of good and a lot of not so good.
Based
but that's
on
the same in all you yeah. know,
and
everybody's
and
art.
there are levels of it, you know, that some of the, as I said before, some of the best paintings produced by this country are produced by that particular machine.
Yep.
So is some of the best furniture, you know, furniture paintings that just look good in a house and they don't have any particular artistic merit.
Yeah, like
other
Howard
Arkley. What I have problem with is when dot painters start making bark paintings or bark painters start making dot paintings and they're out of their cultural kind of area, you know, they're sort of in order to sell.
Well, yep. I think, yes, but you could point that finger at all sorts of different artists.
Or myself.
Well, you could point it absolutely by artists being pushed by their agents and by their galleries to create a certain type of work to fit a certain type of market.
Yeah,
and that's absolutely. Exactly, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I don't think they're told what to do. I think they're told what not to do.
Maybe.
Yeah,
perhaps.
That's it. So do we have a moment?
Do we have, how long are we? No, we have, Brody's rolling his head. We've got one minute.
Okay, I just want to speak about the Red Pill, which is a film made by Cassie Jay, who was well received. She's American, and it's about the MRAs, who are male men's rights activists. And so there's this whole movement which is all about men's rights and how the fact that they're saying women are taking over and interesting
good
field.
Good grief, we've only just started.
I know, this
is
what they
five
say.
Minutes
it's been going
mind.
On for the last 5-10 years and we've had enough. You know,
okay. What do you call it? If it's feminism, what's the opposite?
No, they call it feminazis and manginas, male feminists. And
well, but what's a male...
Misandry.
What's a male...
movement, masculinity movement.
MRAs, that's what it's called. The men's rights activists. Oh, that's what they call MRAs.
Well, that's not very
that's
sexy.
It's not a sexy name, that's for sure.
No,
I think that it could be time for the news.
Okay.
Get your papers ready, everybody. Stephen Haley, Out of Place, is on at McClelland. Out of Place is a collection of paintings, videos, photographs, and explores the artist's fascination with the two defining movements of our age, global urbanisation and the dawn of the digital. It's on at McClelland until December.
I think the world at large should start thinking about putting Gabrielle North in charge of McClelland Gallery.
What a brilliant idea. Dr. Gabe at McClelland Gallery. That could turn a few heads.
Singertown, Frank McGree's short film. We've had Frank in here today about a man in over his head in Bali. It's showing in the short film category of the Melbourne Film Festival. It's on now to the 20th of August, and it's a terrific little film.
Mm.
Go and have a look at it.
Yeah, we do go on about it all the time. The arts are always getting hammering in the annual budget. So we at RRPP are keeping pace with the big commercial stations in content and broadcast, but we need to update some of our equipment. So we're going to, over the next little while, be organising some things to raise some money to help us do that. The first event to kickstart the appeal is a masterclass run by Taking Care of Business presenter and star promotions guru Jackie Mitchell. She'll be sharing useful business tips and trends. There's only 50 places available. Go to the station's website for more details.
So, Faces of Frankston,
mm-hmm.
a new exhibition of photographs from photographer Richard Simpkin, who rose to fame internationally for his epic series of selfies with celebrities. What a load of... as the name suggests, features portraits of Frankston on at FUC, Frankston Art Centre, until 21st of October.
Okay, so this particular series of photographs are apparently inspired when Richard Simpkin visited Frankston some time ago and he found it to be a rather gorgeous place.
Mm.
And he felt the need to present Frankston differently. So
oh
that's where
God.
This series of photographs have come from. Stop it, you. Okay, so if you check out frankstonfaces.com, you will see a little bit more about it.
The Saturday paper, they nurture writers of long-form non-fiction through the Horn Prize and Essay Award. There is an Essay Award valued at $15,000, Mark Stewart.
Jesus.
Yes.
This
are you
year's prize
an
is an essay for up to 3,000 words addressing some part of the theme Australian life, something that you know nothing about.
Clearly.
Yeah. I can write about South Bank.
Anyway, for anybody who's interested in applying for that as well as Mark, go to thehornprize.com.au for details.
Not the horny.
No, the Horn Prize.
Okay. Are you up next, John? Or Oh, no, it's me. 2017-18 Frankston Community Grants, opening 1st of July for applications. Funding is available for local clubs, not-for-profit community groups for startup programs. Grant applications will be received between 1st of July and 30th of July 2017 for the 2017-18 financial year. You can log on to apply from...
No, don't worry about it. We'll put a link on the Facebook page, yes. The next Susie D's production of Looking Glass is on at 45 Downstairs, 2nd of August, so it's open already.
Have you seen it yet?
I'm going to see it, yes. Open until the 13th of August. I think we're just about running out of time, but the production company is back with their second show for 2017, Jesus Christ Superstar, starring Rob Mills, is on at the Frankston Arts Centre.
And up at headquarters, Hokusai.
Hokusai, that's right.
And Tarawarra, the Nobel.
Let's go there. Hello, Cliff. We better get you back in
a second. Yeah,
if you've just tuned in, you've missed Darts About. You can catch up with the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website anytime in the future. The show is repeated on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the website for the station. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
There's nothing you can say.
No, nothing more.
Sorry, Brody.